This is an ABC podcast.
Good morning and welcome to AM. I'm Sabra Lane. On today's program, how Viagra is helping women during childbirth. And as the bushfire threat eases, a call for urgent counselling support for traumatised communities.
Like, the kids are absolutely devastated. They're having nightmares and they're scared and they're just in spins.
Every time the wind turns, more houses are lost, more people come in. We're not counsellors. Our hugs aren't going to do anything much, but, you know, we can do what we can do.
A Northern Territory police officer has been charged with murder after the shooting of a 19-year-old man over the weekend at a Central Australian Aboriginal community. AM's brought you reports during the week about that incident. There's been great community grief and anger in Yuendumu. It's also prompted rallies around the nation, and an Indigenous elder has thanked communities across Australia for their support. The Northern Territory Chief Minister's called for calm and defended the police force. The officer has been granted bail. Thomas Aretti reports.
The death of Kumanjaya Walker has galvanised the small community of Yuendumu, about 260 kilometres northwest of Alice Springs. Just a couple of days ago, residents marched to the police station, the same place they stood on Saturday night, waiting for news of the 19-year-old's condition. But it soon became clear he wasn't coming back. Kumanjaya Walker had been shot and died in police custody. It came on a day when medical help was limited. Yuendumu's health clinic had been evacuated due to safety concerns. Now a police officer has been charged with murder. And while the matter's before the courts, Walbury elder Ned Hargraves has welcomed the news.
I'm over the bloody moon. I'm well, and at least I'm more relaxed now, at ease.
The officer's been identified as Constable Zachary Rolfe. He's 28 years old. Northern Territory Police have confirmed he's been granted bail in an out-of-session local court hearing and suspended on pay. Ned Hargrave says there's a long road ahead, but he's thanked those around Australia who have rallied in support of his community.
I want to say for Sydney, Melbourne, Adelaide, WA, and remote communities, I want to say thank you very much for your support.
In a statement, the Northern Territory Chief Minister, Michael Gunner, says people in Yuendumu and around the territory are hurting and grieving, and he's called for respect and peace.
This is a sad time for all involved. It is a time of high emotion. What I can say, and what is more critical than ever to remember, is that all members of our police force serve us day in, night out, keep us safe, and often put themselves in harm's way. They will be hurting and will need our support.
The officer will appear in an Alice Springs court next month.
Thomas already reporting there. The Federal Shadow Minister for Indigenous Australians, Linda Burney, says she's a little perplexed by the decision to grant bail to the police officer. I spoke with her a short time ago.
It would be very interesting to know how many people are released on bail if there is a murder charge, but I really don't want to get too involved, Sabra, in the legalities. Obviously, there's a coronial inquiry underway, and the family are wanting an independent and thorough investigation, and I have every confidence that that's what's going to take place.
Should that bail, though, be reviewed? Is that...
Look, I really don't think it's appropriate that I comment. There is enormous surprise out there in the community that bail has been given. However, the most important thing that the family is asking for is calm and respect, particularly at the rally in Alice Springs at 10 o'clock this morning, and that the coronial investigation and the investigations into the circumstances are done thoroughly and independently.
You're confident that will happen?
I am confident that that will happen. I think that this, in the context of what's happening in the Territory at the moment, the fact that the federal government is going to introduce a cashless debit card without any discussion People are still very much feeling the wrath of the intervention. The poverty, the lack of clean water in communities is something that most people would be astounded at. And those broad issues are what people are very frustrated about as well.
And that's the Shadow Minister for Indigenous Australians, Linda Burney. Fire conditions have eased along the eastern seaboard with no blazes currently at emergency level. In New South Wales, fire bans have been lifted, but more than 70 fires are still burning, most in the state's north, and it remains in a state of emergency. In Queensland, cooler temperatures and easing winds could help firefighters get the upper hand today. About 20 new fires flared yesterday. There are about 80 in total. And across the Nullarbor in Geraldton on WA's Midwest Coast, a fire there has been downgraded from emergency to watch and act. Four homes were lost there yesterday. A coalition of 23 former fire and emergency services chiefs has managed to secure a meeting with the Federal Minister for Emergency Services, David Littleproud. Greg Mullins is a member of the group and a former commissioner for Rural and Rescue New South Wales. He says he's disappointed the Prime Minister wouldn't meet with his group earlier this year.
We saw it coming. We were all, most of us have 40 up to 50 years service in the emergency services. We tried to warn the government. But look, let's draw a line under that. We have a meeting with Minister Littleproud, and I believe he's a person who does have open ears. We'd like the Prime Minister to be there also. We have good practical suggestions.
Mr. Mullins was speaking there on RN Breakfast. For many residents in New South Wales, fatigue is already a major problem. They've been dealing with the risk and fires now for weeks. Julia Holman reports from Wingham on the New South Wales Mid-North Coast.
The threat from fires is far from over for Sally McDonnell.
They reckon it's going to get worse before it gets better again.
She's staying at the Wingham Showground, which has been converted into a makeshift evacuation centre, after nearby blazes forced her to evacuate her home at Kundabark, around 20 kilometres away.
I had ash and embers dropping on the house and it was getting closer. I've got 9 horses, 3 dogs, cat and a bird, and I didn't want to risk anything happening to them.
Have you heard about how your place is?
Yes, at the moment it's okay, but the fire is getting close. It's about 4 kilometres away. So if the wind changes or anything, you just don't know what's going to happen.
While the McDonalds don't know if their home will survive, others are facing the overwhelming task of having to rebuild.
My place is gone, completely gone, burnt to the ground, 100%.
Emily Smith lost her Bowburn home last Friday. She says her 3 kids are traumatised by what they've seen.
We went through flames at 110 kilometres an hour, dodging logs, debris, flames, everything, with the dogs in the back yelping, with kids in the car screaming. No, it was horrific.
And even at the evacuation centre at Wingham, they're not out of danger.
We're going through it again and again. Like, we were up 4 a.m. this morning going around making sure there were no embers on the ground. Like, we can't go to sleep.
Emily Smith says her family is at breaking point.
There's been no social workers or anything come out yet. I think the kids and everyone else would really appreciate someone to actually sit down and talk to and go through the events with them. But there's been no one out here.
The responsibility for supporting these families has largely gone to volunteers like Donna Price, who's preparing food for the evacuees.
We're just trying to make sure that everybody has enough to eat, and when they do come in that they can get something quick and hearty and healthy.
Kylie Murray established the makeshift evacuation centre last week. She's offering whatever help she can.
We have everything from clothes to toiletries to food to beer to coffee, everything. We can't put the fires out and we can't take the tears away, but we can at least give them a hug to know they're not alone.
But volunteer Debbie Jess says there's a limit to the support that they can give to those in need.
They're going to need counselling. A lot of them today, I've spoken to a few that said, we need counsellors out here now. We just try and support best we can, but we're not counsellors. Our hugs aren't going to do anything much, but, you know, we can do what we can do.
That's volunteer Debbie Jess and Julia Holman reporting there at Wingham on the New South Wales Mid-North Coast. Unprecedented. That's how Australia's main spy agency, ASIO, has characterised the current level of foreign interference and espionage in Australia. Today, the federal government's releasing guidelines for universities aimed at reducing that problem, requiring educational institutions to keep staff and students safe and ensure research remains in trusted hands. comes off the back of a high-profile cyber hack of systems at the Australian National University and collaborations between Australian universities and Chinese researchers with strong links to the People's Liberation Army. Tom Eagledon reports.
There's concern among intelligence agencies about what's happening on Australian campuses after media reports in 2017 detailed links between China's military and researchers collaborating on sensitive projects at Australian universities. Dan Tehan is the Federal Education Minister.
We're really now beginning to clearly understand the unprecedented level of foreign interference in Australia, and therefore we've put these guidelines in place to deal with that.
The new approach is the result of months of talks with the sector and a conference 2 months ago to hammer out details. Universities shared their experience of the massive hack of Australian National University data earlier this year, and the government raised concerns about media reports of worrisome research collaborations with overseas academics.
What we've got to make sure is that we're putting the checks in place as to who we're collaborating with, that we know what the research will be used for, and that our universities are aware of the background of the scientists that they're dealing with. If these guidelines are properly implemented and properly enacted, then our preparedness to deal with foreign interference on our university campuses will be far greater than what it's been previously.
And are you confident they will be properly enacted, that this will be taken seriously? Is that there has been a change in attitude from the universities?
Every indication that I've got is that there has been a change of attitude.
Much of this is happening inside universities already. This is a way of putting it all down on paper.
That's Katrina Jackson, CEO of Universities Australia, which helped to draw up the guidelines.
What will change is you will see a more unified, concerted partnership between government and universities as we all confront what is an increasingly complex world.
Can you see some of the collaborations, for example, with China that may have happened in the past? And I'm thinking here of some of those links with some Chinese academics with strong links to the Chinese military. Do you think those sorts of collaborations may not happen in the future thanks to these guidelines?
I think it is a mistake to single out one country in this conversation, Tom. I think we will be looking at all collaborations inside universities.
Well, let's take China out of it. Do you think there are collaborations generally that could have happened in the past that may not happen now that these questions are being asked at a deeper level?
Look, it may be there are some changes and there's sorts of collaborations that are entered into, but I say again, it is very, very important that we as a sector do not pull back from large international collaborations.
The conversation between the government and universities is ongoing. A review is due next year.
That's political reporter Tom Eagledon. It's fair to say everyone held out great hopes for the National Disability Insurance Scheme, and there have been some examples of people receiving great support. But there are also many dispiriting examples of parents waiting a long time to have plans approved for their kids and then waiting again before they can actually access services. Stuart Robert was given the ministry and job of fixing the rollout problems. He's speaking at the National Press Club later today about its progress, and he joined me earlier. Minister, good morning and welcome to AM.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm well, thanks. Last time we spoke, you promised to slash waiting times for plan approvals for kids. At that point, it was 127 days on average to 50 days by October. Have you achieved it?
It's now at 48 days, so absolutely we have.
What about adults? Many service providers have told the ABC that their waiting time, approvals for waiting times have really blown out. Has that been the consequence of this?
No, waiting times, when I came into the portfolio, in terms of from access to a plan, were 130 days, and they've come right down now into the 80s. So they're coming down as well. And importantly, when after the election, there were over 13,000 Australians waiting over 21 days for access into the NDIS. That, of course, now is zero. There is no waiting list for people to access into the NDIS scheme.
Those providers are telling us that the times have blown out. So what, they've got it wrong?
Well, it's a large scheme and there's lots of people all over the country. And I look at the big macro numbers at the top and I know categorically there is no one waiting for access. There's no backlog over the 21 days. And I know from access to plan, those numbers have well and truly come down across the nation from 130 down into the 80s. Now, they're just statements of facts. Now, there will be different numbers, of course, in different areas. And depending upon demand, some areas may have greater demand than others.
The ABC put in a freedom of application on this. Turned back 49 pages, most of them completely blacked out. Do you find that embarrassing?
Oh, well, I'm not aware of the actual issue, so I can't actually respond with any granularity of detail.
It was well out there on last week and on the weekend. Certainly, it was out there on social media and on TV, the number of pages that were completely blacked out.
Well, it doesn't mean I'm across it. It doesn't mean I read everything that you put out on social media, although I'm sure it's very good. So, no, if I'm not across it, it's very hard to comment on it.
But does it, on the substance itself, does that embarrass you? The FIY that's come back from your department, 49 pages, most of them completely blacked out.
Well, I don't know what the questions were.
So again, it was about waiting times.
It's very hard to answer.
Well, you say it's hard to answer, but this information is being hidden from taxpayers and it's come from your department.
Well, today we released the quarterly report, which has all the detail regarding access times, waiting times and every other bit of detail as well.
Do you concede, though, that that's not a good look?
Again, I'm not across the questions were asked or the information was being requested. But in terms of the NDIA...
But this has come from your department. So this is... I'm telling you, and it's fact.
There's probably no greater agency in this country that is as data-rich as the NDIA or produces as much data as the NDIA, as the September report today will testify.
Will you make inquiries about this? Like, you're not curious about the FOI requests that are coming to your department and the fact that they're releasing close to zip information about it?
Well, every time issues are raised with me, the media will always go and actually find out what the substance of the issue is and see if we can improve and make things better. That's a standing thing I do in my office.
There are now 310,000 people on the NDIS. That's up from, I think, 298,000 in April, a 4% increase. How many of those people are happy with the service plans they're getting?
The NDIA does a range of surveys from when people access the scheme right the way through to their plan. In fact, they do three touch point surveys and the satisfaction's in the 90s. Now, I'd like to get it into the high 90s. That would be lovely. But of course, we're still building the scheme as we're servicing the scheme. So whilst the PC says once we're business as usual, if you like, there'll be somewhere between 14 to 15,000 people per annum coming through, this 12 months will have over 120,000. Now, the analogy is being given of building the plane whilst you fly it. That's probably apt. So there's going to be some teething challenges whilst we get the last range of people in this year. At the same time, though, we have to aim to give as best service as we possibly can.
The productivity draft report on mental health highlighted the problem of people with mental health issues not applying for coverage under the NDIS. They were saying that 42,000 people are probably eligible for that, but they haven't yet applied. Why do you think they're not wanting to sign up to this?
So the original Productivity Commission estimates from 2011 estimated about 17% of the scheme, give or take, will be from people suffering from psychosocial. It's currently 9 or 10%. And there is a range and a myriad of reasons, and there's not just one.
You worry about that?
No, absolutely. That's why we've put the Community Connector program in place. It was an election commitment, which is really a nice way of saying we're going to actually get out there and find Australians that need help, not just in remote and Indigenous communities and linguistically difficult communities, but in areas like psychosocial, where just the numbers aren't meeting the expectations. There might be some fear, might be some unknown, people aren't across the information. There could be a raft of reasons, and we want to actually go and find them and provide services to them.
Do you acknowledge that for some Australians it's not meeting expectations?
Expectations are very high, but remember, this is a world-leading scheme. It's never been tried on this scale before, ever. And this is the only area of public policy where every single plan is individual and unique for a citizen. Now, we've got very thin markets out there, thin providers. We need something like 70,000 more attendant carers, perhaps up to 90,000 new workers. There are challenges in the provision of service out there. We are short 4,000 or 5,000 houses for specialist disability accommodation that are being built. There are 89% more houses right now at over 3,500 than there were last year. So we're building this aircraft fast, but there are always challenges, and I acknowledge that people, or some people, will find it challenging.
Given all of that, how wise then it is to grant the new chief of the NDIS $160,000 extra to his pay packet, making it $750,000? Why do that?
He's on less than the previous CEO, so Rob De Luca, who was the previous CEO.
Still, that's a massive amount of money, more than the Prime Minister.
Well, every departmental secretary is on more than the Prime Minister as well, can I say, and this is a departmental secretary level position. He was the former Secretary of Department of Innovation, Service and Finance in the New South Wales Government, former CEO of 9MSN, very experienced executive, and he's being paid at slightly less than the previous CEO.
Minister, thanks for your time this morning.
Great pleasure.
That's Stuart Robert, the Minister for the National Disability Insurance Scheme. The first of a series of open hearings investigating whether Donald Trump has committed an impeachable offence has been told that the Trump administration actively pushed for an investigation into Democrats in exchange for a White House meeting and security assistance for Ukraine. The inquiry was launched after an anonymous whistleblower's complaint that Mr. Trump pressured Ukraine's president to investigate his Democratic foe, Joe Biden, and Biden's son, all while the US was holding up US military aid. Washington correspondent Zoe Daniel joined me earlier from outside the hearing.
Sabra, you have two quite credible witnesses, and they have been hand-picked by the Democrats for that reason. One, George Kent, is a career State Department staffer, is an expert in Ukraine. The other, Ambassador Bill Taylor, is the acting ambassador to Ukraine, but was the ambassador previously and has a lifetime of public service. They're both very articulate. And essentially, they have built a story around the fact that they say there was a two-track foreign policy going on, one formal that they were involved in, and then a second, less formal track that was being run by the president's personal lawyer, Rudy Giuliani. And both of them say in different ways that over a period of months, they became aware that two things were being put before the Ukrainian government by the Trump administration. One was the prospect of a White House meeting between the Ukrainian president and President Trump. And the other was this issue of security aid. Now, this is security aid that was given to Ukraine after the downing of MH17. And these two Ukraine experts say that the Trump administration was essentially playing that off, suggesting that the Ukrainian government would have to investigate Hunter Biden and his involvement in business in Ukraine. He, of course, is the son of Democratic candidate Joe Biden. And that also the Ukrainian government should investigate whether Ukraine was working with the Democrats in 2016 to meddle in the election. Here's what Bill Taylor, the acting ambassador, had to say.
Following that meeting, in the presence of my staff, at a restaurant, Ambassador Sondland called President Trump and told him of his meetings in Kyiv. The member of my staff could hear President Trump on the phone asking Ambassador Sondland about the investigations. Ambassador Sondland told President Trump the Ukrainians were ready to move forward. Following the call with President Trump, the member of my staff asked Ambassador Sondland what President Trump thought about Ukraine. Ambassador Sondland responded that President Trump cares more about the investigations of Biden, which Giuliani was pressing for.
Zoe, how significant that the doors have been opened up and the hearings have been made public?
Well, I think the significance is that many of these witnesses, if not all of them, have already been deposed privately, and many people like me have already read those depositions, but the majority of Americans, of course, have not. The Republicans say that this is all for show, and perhaps it is, that these two men that are being deposed today were chosen because they're good TV talent, and that may well be true in the sense that the Democrats need to get these witnesses in front of the voting public in order for there to be public support for impeachment. And I think, Sabra, once several of these key witnesses have been brought forward and Democrats feel that they've put forward enough evidence, even if it's hearsay from these witnesses, will then move forward to an impeachment vote in the House. There's a suggestion that that could happen before Christmas.
And that's Zoe Daniel there. Anti-government protests in Lebanon have been invigorated by the nation's president, who said if those people taking to the streets didn't like their leaders, then they should immigrate. More protests are expected today after the funeral of a protester shot at a roadblock. Here's Middle East correspondent Adam Harvey.
Protesters are rattling the razor wire 1.5 kilometres from Lebanon's presidential palace. But even at that distance, there's a good chance that Michelle Aoun can hear the commotion. Until now, the nation's political leaders had attempted to find common ground with the protesters who had brought Lebanon to a standstill. 84-year-old Michelle Aoun has broken ranks. First, he blamed the protesters for wrecking the nation's economy. If they keep going, there is a catastrophe. If they stop, there is still room for us to fix things. And then a statement that's been taken as a deep insult. In a nation where there are so few jobs, graduates expect to leave to find work. If they don't like it and they can't find a single decent person in power, then they can emigrate.
And he has half of his country asking him to step down, and he says if you're not happy, you can emigrate.
I'm not sure what to say. It was absurd.
Like most of Lebanon's political leaders, Aoun is a product of the nation's long civil war. He's a former head of the army and, for many protesters, the embodiment of out-of-touch politicians.
Plus, you have a whole new generation that was born after the war. They don't even relate to, Christian versus Christian, Druze versus Christian, Shiite versus Sunni. They don't even relate to that.
And you're putting your time and your money, I suppose, where your mouth is. You're helping to feed people.
We are.
But tell me about that. Why did you decide to do that?
Well, today I have two boys who are teenagers and who are not going to school. My business is collapsing. I can't go to work sometimes. But, you know, what's next? I mean, where are we going to stay and accept that there's no electricity, that there is no water, that there are no proper sewages? How long were you going to stay to do that? So yes, it comes at a sacrifice. It comes at my kids not going to school. It comes at some people, even in worse situation, not getting their wages, not getting their salaries. Of course.
There's a risk of more trouble today after one of the first funerals of these protests. A man shot in the head by a soldier, apparently during an argument at a roadblock. The man's wife and child were with him when he was shot. This is Adam Harvey in Beirut for AM.
The drug Viagra is normally associated with blokes and helping them with problems down there. Yet it turns out this drug might also be helpful for women in labour. Emergency deliveries can be traumatic and very risky for babies. But an Australian obstetrician believes he's found a way to reduce the number of caesarean and assisted births using the active ingredient in Viagra. Here's medical reporter Sophie Scott.
Joe Wright's little boy is a healthy, happy 2-year-old. Before he was born, she wanted a family of 5. Now she's not so sure.
It's really scary, the idea of having another baby.
Her labour started off normally, but after 40 hours, her baby's heart rate dropped dangerously low. She was told Philip was in distress and was rushed into theatre for an emergency caesarean.
There was no time for anything. They told me straight out, my baby was coming out.
Professor Sailesh Kumar from the Mater Research Institute says he may have found a way to reduce the number of women who have a similar experience. He conducted a trial where women with full-term pregnancies were given sildenafil, otherwise known as Viagra, once they were in labour.
The rationale for using sildenafil in this context is really to try and improve blood supply to the uterus and to the placenta.
In labour, during contractions, blood flow to the baby can drop by as much as 60%. The drug, which is commonly used as a treatment for erectile dysfunction, helps counter this because it dilates blood vessels in the pelvis.
The blood vessels in the uterus actually get pinched off because of the contractions of the womb. By dilating these blood vessels, the baby gets more oxygen in between contractions.
Professor Kumar's trial was carried out in 300 women. Half were given the drug and half were given a placebo. They found the medication halved the number of mums needing caesareans or forceps deliveries.
It is obviously a small study, and our promising initial results need to be validated in a much larger study.
To do that, he's applied for funding to validate the findings amongst 8,500 women in 17 hospitals across Australia. Fellow obstetrician Dr. Sean Siho says the findings are promising.
If Viagra does prove to be beneficial and reduce fetal distress in labour, then certainly this would be a very effective way to reduce caesarean sections.
For Jo Wright, that prospect brings her great relief.
To know that that risk could be halved is pretty huge, and I'd actually like to try for it.
That's Mum Jo Wright, Sophie Scott reporting there. That's AM for today. Thanks for your company. I'm Sabra Lane.
Hi,
I'm Ruby Jones.
And I'm Chris Dengate, and we're from the ABC's daily news podcast, The Signal.
On Monday, a police officer in Hong Kong shot an unarmed 21-year-old protester at point-blank range.
Later that day, a middle-aged man was doused in petrol and set alight after arguing with protesters.
With tactics on both sides becoming more extreme and violent, we look at the changing face of the battle for Hong Kong.
Find The Signal on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.